So Aaron, how you doing?
I'm good, Bob. I'm actually doing good. I'm working on my president's book, Can America Have Another Great President? It's coming out in 2012. Fascinating stuff.
That's excellent. I look forward to reading it, and it's just in time for a presidential election, it sounds like.
It is, actually. It's a guide to presidential greatness during an election year, which will be really quite interesting.
That's,
meanwhile, just ID, I'm Aaron David Miller. I'm a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington. Served in Republican, Democratic administrations, primarily providing advice, some good, but frankly, most not so good, on Arab-Israeli negotiations.
I'd actually chip in and say you probably know more about the Arab-Israeli peace process and its successes and failures over time than any other living person, with the possible exception, I suppose, of Dennis Ross, although it's possible that you know more than Dennis does.
Well, one of us is the Cal Ripken of the Arab-Israeli peace process. I'm not sure which one that should be, but hopefully we'll only spend part of our time talking about the Arab-Israeli issue.
Well, let's start with this. I remember that you and I were at a lunch at a local European embassy in Washington, D.C., that was being held for a prominent European foreign minister, in which I know I predicted, but I think you seconded me in this prediction, that there was no way that during a year when Iran was going to figure so prominently and negotiations with Iran were going to be sort of the hallmark of this administration's first year in office, that they would simultaneously really gear themselves up to push hard on the Middle East peace process, including putting real pressure on Israel. I will admit to having been proven wrong about that. But are you surprised that they've taken this course?
I guess differentiate between what I would call consequential actions the administration has taken, appointing George Mitchell, giving this issue a high public profile, and yes, putting considerable pressure on the government of Israel on settlement activity from what I would call a determinative approach. It's not entirely clear to me yet that they really have a strategy or a policy on which they're prepared to follow through. I do believe, though, that Iran has offered up, not just on the Arab-Israeli issue, but perhaps with respect to Hezbollah and Hamas and even Islamic authoritarianism, a real opening, which will probably play out over time. So it may well be that Iran, in a paradoxical way, may even encourage some openings on this one rather than discourage, which was my view, as you correctly put it, several months ago.
Well, how does that work? Why does it encourage progress on the peace process?
Well, I think you have a situation in which Iran, however it comes out, and we're not talking about a fundamental revolution here, I don't think that's what's at stake. What's at stake is whether the powers of the Iranian state will be able to consolidate their control and how much time they're going to have to spend addressing internal issues, fixing the economy, trying to figure out where the new balance of power is going to lie. And I'm not entirely sure that in that situation their allies, two non-state actors, Hamas and Hezbollah, functioning in two non-state environments are going to get all that much money, all that much time, and all that much attention. So I think that that's one point. Second, Iran may well be knocked down a peg or two. It had, in part because we facilitated it, created an image of itself as a kind of a regional superpower, defeating great powers, backing smaller ones who defeated regional powers, in this case Israel. And I suspect that, nothing succeeds like success and nothing fails like failure. And I think the bubble on Iran's infallibility may have burst.
Well, that's interesting analysis. I guess that makes sense on the Hamas side. I guess I would wonder whether there isn't a wild card, though, which is the possibility of an Israeli strike against Iran. I mean, on a scale of 1 to 100, 100 being cosmic certainty, where would you place the likelihood of an Israeli action? I personally, after June 12th, would say that it went up a little bit.
You know, it's interesting because I'm not sure. I never thought that, even though the prospects of the Israelis unilaterally striking Iran in an effort to retard, if they couldn't destroy its nuclear capacity, always struck me as kind of low on the probability scale. On the possibility scale, maybe, but as we approach the reality of what such a strike would mean, what it was designed to accomplish, how the United States would react, it always struck me as something that was over the horizon. I'm not sure, frankly, the odds have gone up. I'm not sure they've gone down. But I do believe that, sadly, whatever is happening on the streets isn't going to affect the nuclear issue. The Iranians are determined, it seems to me, to push their nuclear program, maybe to one step short of weaponization, maybe to weaponization. But politics in this case, Bob, and I don't know how you see it, isn't going to stop science and technology.
Well, I guess that raises the question of the Obama administration's strategy now. I think there's been a lot of hopeful speculation by some that the events of June 12th have sort of convinced the Obama administration that they really can't negotiate with Ahmadinejad and Khamenei. But I guess I put myself in the skeptics category. I think that the administration is going to go full bore ahead to try to engage in negotiations as soon as conceivably possible. I guess the first question I have for you is, do you agree with that? But second of all, what do you think the likelihood of success of that, of negotiations are going to be?
I never put much faith in this from the beginning, in large part because Iran's objectives, particularly under the Mollahocracy, seem to be incompatible on the core issues. On Afghanistan, on Iraq, I suspect there might have been room for some significant overlap, but on Lebanon, on support for Hamas, on the Arab-Israeli issue, on preeminence in the Gulf, on the nuclear issue, it seemed to me that the Iranians, driven as they are by a profound sense of entitlement on one hand and insecurity on the other, really weren't going to transform themselves into a domesticated power along the lines that we wanted them to. So I saw negotiations as desirable, at least to test the possibility, but I had no great hopes that there was any great bargain or grand deal that was somehow going to transform Iran's bid for regional hegemony, even in its own smaller region, into something else. So I kind of think it's still a key to an empty room. I'm wondering, though, how the administration is going to finesse the problem that they have, which is de facto, presumably, recognition of this particular government. I mean, what explanation do they use in these circumstances for lending legitimacy to a regime that has already demonstrated its repressive power and is prepared, I would think, under circumstances that you and I could both imagine, to become even more repressive? So I don't know where this goes, which leaves open the possibility that the clock on weaponization continues to tick. I did find it interesting that Meir Dagan, the head of Mossad, was quoted recently as saying that he thought Iran would cross the nuclear threshold not until 2014. Now, I don't know how authoritative that is, but it's an intriguing statement from an Israeli institution that seemed in the past to think that the Iranians were on a much faster track.
Well, if that's true, then the Israelis would feel a lot less pressure to take any action in the near term.
Right. I would think that's right.
I guess I feel like it's to your question that they're not going to have any difficulty justifying, certainly to themselves, going ahead with negotiating with the regime, even if it does suggest legitimizing it, because they're going to say, look, the bottom line is getting them to stop their nuclear program. There's nothing more important. And they're the government that's in power, and what do you want us to do anyway, Aaron, they might say.
Right. Well, no, I think I would argue that the Obama administration, unlike both of its immediate predecessors, both Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, has a greater chance of seeing the world the way it really is, the way Bob Kagan sees it, for example.
I'm sure they'd be delighted to be placed in that company.
Rather than the way they want the world to be. But, you know, this isn't the former Soviet Union or even the Soviet Union we're talking about, where over a 30-year period you have a set of rules which the Russians and the Americans had worked out. I mean, beginning with Roosevelt's relationship, artificial though it may have been, with Stalin, here you have a situation into an already dysfunctional non-relationship between Iran and the U.S., 30 years old. You're going to inject now serious and sustained negotiations at a time when the Iranian government is repressing its own citizens in the street, and may have to use violence, sometimes on a weekly basis, in order to maintain control. And into this, here we come with an American Secretary of State or President that's going to negotiate on one of the most sensitive issues. I mean, I'm not sure I get the incentives and disincentives now into this new situation.
Well, I think I see it the way you see it, but I don't know that the Obama administration agrees, or maybe some parts of the Obama administration would agree with you, because I think that, in fact, their much-vaunted realism is perhaps not as realistic and grounded as people think. I think they are continuing to pursue policy based on a paradigm that every day is collapsing around them. The paradigm was, we don't really have a problem with the Iranian regime that can't be resolved through talks. The problem was George Bush's policies. We don't really have any differences that can't be resolved with the Russians. The problem was George Bush. Same with North Korea and with any other problem that we've been having in the world. And they seem to be convinced that this remains to be the case, that this remains the case, and that all they need to do is sort of reverse whatever they think the policies were of the previous 8 years, and they can pull a rabbit out of the hat. I don't see a lot of evidence that they are, in fact, understanding what you, I think, very clearly and correctly put as the true reality, which is that there's no deal to be had with this regime on this kind of core strategic and even, I would say, regime issue. Obviously, I think this government, just like Kim Jong-il, thinks that having a nuclear weapon is not only a means of securing them against a potential foreign attack, but it's also a means of securing their position within their own country. But I'm not persuaded when I hear David Axelrod speaking for the administration on TV, when I see the leaks coming out of statements by officials, I'm not at all persuaded that they see the world the way you do, Aaron.
I mean, certainly given the numerous failures that I've been involved in over the years on the Arab-Israeli issue, you know, seeing the world the way I do may not be, you know, the right prescription. It's just, I can't imagine that the drivers of this administration, the President, the Secretary of State, see the world as a world in 2009 that is just, you know, crying out for their skillful hands to resolve conflicts in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Lebanon, in the Arab-Israeli issue, in democratization, and Pakistan and Iran. I mean, it strikes me that any level-headed person, without abandoning hope, and I'm not a declinist when it comes to American power, and I don't want to be identified as one, doesn't look at the world and say, hey, the world, at least that part of the world, it needs to be managed. Maybe we can resolve pieces of it, but we're not going to pursue some sort of transformational diplomacy which is based on the notion of, yes, we can, a kind of morphing of the administration's or the president's campaign slogan, because the region offers up precisely the opposite, which is, no, you can't. It's hard for me to imagine, as I sit with no responsibility, removed from any influence at all on these matters, that people don't see this clearly and without illusion. particularly given the information that you and I know, senior-level officials in our government have access to. Now, it's possible to be blinded to these realities because diplomacy, and I would offer myself up as an example, particularly when it works once, you begin to believe in it. I mean, I'm not a religious person, but I accepted diplomacy as a sort of article of faith in negotiations as a kind of, you know, sacred ritual that could actually work. I mean, I can't believe, looking at the Middle East over the last 16 years, that the new guys and the Secretary of State somehow look at the world, this piece of it, as a land of diplomatic opportunity. It's extraordinary if that's the way they're looking at it.
Well, how do you explain then, the tackling of the issue, the attempt to tackle the issues of settlements?
I think that's an effort that was strongly argued by some of the president's advisors, that they had seen the Bibi Netanyahu movie before, particularly Rahm Emanuel, who saw it in 96 to 99, and probably argued to the president that, you know, we need an honest process, and let's get off from the get-go to try to create the basis of an honest process. We're not going to let the Israelis create these facts on the ground, and we're not going to let the Arabs continue in their you know, profound denial with respect to Israel's right to exist and the kind of confidence builders that are required to convince the Israelis that the Arab world accepts them. So they set out, it seems to me, to try to get something from Israel that they could then leverage with the Saudis and others to produce some positive steps. I think they got out ahead of themselves. I think that they allowed their frustrations with Israel and their desire to be different from the previous administration to influence their thinking, and I think they got themselves into a position in which they've now demanded publicly, and the president's speech in Cairo now stands as a kind of emblem to this, that they need a comprehensive freeze, including natural growth. And the question now is whether or not they will be open to some fix which the Israelis will propose to get the administration off this issue and on to focusing on a real strategy that would get them where they want to go. Because right now they're all dressed up, but there's no party to go with. And I've said this many times, that fighting with the Israelis is worth it, but not because you're frustrated with them, not to make nice to the Arabs, but you fight with Israel if you have to, because you can achieve a real breakthrough in a negotiation that makes you look good, that advances American interests, and that also advances Israeli interests and Arab interests. And I don't see that strategy, Bob. That's the real problem. I have no problem in wrestling with the Israelis, but the stakes of the wrestling match need to be worth it.
Well, I'm sure the administration officials who were conducting this policy, if they were here right now, would say, look, we had to gain our bona fides in the region. We had to demonstrate a willingness to take Israel on. And now that we have, and I'm sure, you know, if you read the press coverage, Obama looks like he's forcing Bibi to make some concessions, which, you know, they can now, I'm sure they think, take to the Arabs and get some concessions on that side. I mean, what's wrong with that strategy that I'm sure they think is precisely the strategy they're pursuing?
Nothing if it works. But the problem here is not the Arabs at the moment. The problem is that they're in a hurry to get to a negotiation that is likely to lead almost immediately to a dead end. And here is the real problem. You've got four core issues: Jerusalem, border, security, and refugees, that if today the Prime Minister of Israel sat down with the President of Palestine or their respective negotiators sat down, they'd have a hard time finding common ground, real common ground, on any of those four issues. So I think that we've allowed ourselves to be diverted to some degree from the real problem, and that is a conflict-ending agreement between Israelis and Palestinians in 2009 may not be possible. Now, I can't say it's impossible, but in order to have any chance of breaking through, you really do need to determine what your ultimate strategy is going to be. And it's not a strategy, frankly, that should focus first and foremost on settlement activity or even CBMs from the Arabs. It's whether or not the positions of the currently constituted government of Israel and the dysfunctional, divided, and Humpty Dumpty-like Palestinian national movement are congruent. And that's the real issue to me, and I hope they're thinking about it.
Well, presumably somebody's thinking about it, and we know some of the people who are making policy, or presumably making policy. One of them has just apparently been shifted from the State Department to the National Security Council and is closer to the president than he was before. I'm talking about Dennis Ross. You know, it's a Washington parlor game now to decide how much power does Dennis have, what's happened to Dennis, and all that. But Dennis has been around the block on all these issues and is, I think, known for being capable of thinking in strategic terms. I mean, don't you think he knows the same things that you know?
I do, but I also know that when you get into government, it is quite understandable that a yes, we can is almost always the mantra, and no, you can't is simply unacceptable. And I understand the dilemma. I mean, you can't do nothing. America is not a potted plant. But my trope these days is, you know, trying and failing as somehow better than not trying at all is, in my judgment, not necessarily an appropriate response for a foreign policy of the greatest power on earth. And I'm just suggesting that before we act, and I don't think we've done so on the issue of settlements, we need to think this through extremely clearly. We don't need another failure. And I would argue, and you and I probably will disagree about this, I would argue that over the last 16 years, 8 under Bill Clinton and 8 under George W. Bush, America has been failing. We've stumbled at how to assist Arabs and Israelis in making peace, and we've stumbled even more galactically in how to prosecute a discretionary war. And I wonder, again, I'm not a declinist, and I do not want to be identified as one, but I wonder, how do we operate as a superpower when, in fact, we don't have a strategy for peacemaking or war making? And I believe in negotiations. I'm not going to mortgage the future by saying that there's no Israeli-Palestinian deal possible. I question whether or not we're smart enough, tough enough, and ultimately fair enough to deliver on this. And above all, I don't want us to pursue this with illusion. And that's what we're really good at. That's why we're Americans, because we look at the world in a particular way. Sometimes, frankly, that's not the way the world really is.
I just think you're just not with it, Aaron, to the degree to which you seem not to understand that a new day has dawned. That we have a president in the White House who is unlike any previous leader America has ever had. His message in Cairo, among other things, was forget about the America you know. I'm a different America. And I take no responsibility for the sins that America's committed. I freely admit those sins that others committed. Based on my heritage and who I am, I'm a different animal. I'm a different kind of a person out there. And that the power of Barack Obama is a power for change. And I think that I really believe that a lot of people in this administration are caught up in that idea, that he is different, and so the old rules don't apply.
Bob, I know you believe that's what they believe. I just am concerned. And Barack Obama may be a transformational figure. I mean, there's no question about it. Whether he has the elements that will, after one or two terms, elevate him to the level of greatness in our presidents isn't clear. And I don't want to prejudge that one way or the other.
Well, look, let me ask you this. You know a lot of people in the Arab world. You've spent a tremendous amount of time there. How much of a difference do you think it makes to the average influential Palestinian or Arab leader or maybe just the average person in the street that Barack Obama's president? How transformational do you think they see this in terms of what can affect American policy toward them?
I think words are important, but as you and I know, deeds matter more. I think that from their perspective, the hole that America is in is very deep, that it requires an enormous amount of digging to get out, that it's not a question of what have you done for me yesterday, the speech in Cairo. The question is, what have you done for me now? And I think with that sort of logic, the logic of the potted plant, which is, well, now you have a guy who's going to somehow emerge to rescue us by beating up on the Israelis and by breaking through in ways that we haven't seen in American presidents. I think there are people who believe that, but I think that the Arabs are far too experienced in American policy, far too cynical with respect to American behavior, to somehow take Barack Obama at his word.
Are they wrong? Are they right or wrong?
Look, I believe deeply in the power of America. I also believe even more deeply in the limitations of that power. And I don't want to prejudge this one way or the other, but history, which you and I know well, is the greatest guard against the two elements that great powers need to be constantly on guard against. One is omniscience, the fact that we know everything. And the other is omnipotence, the fact that we can do anything. And if you're suggesting to me that this is the way, omnipotence and omniscience, or some variation of that, is the way that Barack Obama is approaching the world, a world that will be there long after he departs from the presidency, with conflicts driven by memory, historical trauma, identity, ethnic rivalry, sectarian violence. If you're suggesting to me that Barack Obama approaches the world with, I'm going to fix all this, first of all, I don't believe he believes it. He's too smart. And if he does believe it, we're in for a real crash and burn.
Well, Woodrow Wilson was very smart. He believed it. But I'm actually asking a more specific question, not whether America has the capacity, but as Arabs look at Barack Obama, do they believe at least this, that he breaks the mold of traditional America, a traditional American approach to the region, that he is likely to take a very untraditional approach to the region, or do they look at him and say, whatever his nice words in Cairo, whatever fight he wants to pick up with the Israelis over settlements, at the end of the day, they expect him to behave roughly as past American presidents have behaved?
I would argue that all but those who have profound illusions about American policy believe the latter. That in the end, they understand that Barack Obama, for some, is a kind of Rorschach test. The fact that he's the first black president, the fact that he uses civil rights metaphors, the fact that his middle name is Hussein, the fact that he spent time in Indonesia, the fact that he has Muslim blood in his family, give rise to real hope and real expectation. But I think among most very sophisticated and smart, not in the book sense of the word, but in the street sense of the word, Arab observers, analysts, government officials, this is a work very much in progress. They hope it to be the case, but they're not convinced.
Well, I know you're interested in the way governments function. You spent a tremendous amount of time in government, much more than I did. How does this government look like it's functioning to you as a kind of, in foreign policy terms, in terms of how well it functions as a foreign policy producer?
You know, it's interesting because I guess I would separate the first 5 or 6 months into the consequential as opposed to the determinative. I mean, it's clear that there are at least three distinguishing characteristics that seem to separate this administration from its immediate predecessor. Number one is it doesn't see the world in transformational terms, I don't think. Big ideas, democratization as a kind of answer to much of what ails the region, or at least American orchestrated democratization. Preemptive or preventative use of military power. I think this administration is very wary of changing regimes and using military force to fix problems. It's much more transactional. That is to say, the world is filled with problems. Some are black, some are white, but there's a lot of gray, and negotiation really is our preferred pathway. So that's number one. Number two, I think they're prepared to admit, to a degree that even I find surprising, previous errors, transgressions, mistakes in American policy. Any more of it, however, and I think I'm gonna end up getting a headache. I mean, great powers are never loved. I mean, maybe they're feared, maybe they're respected, and maybe they're admired, but great powers who are literally in the neighborhood of small tribes, pushing them around sometimes, forcing them to do things, telling them what to do, we're not going to be loved, and apologizing for everything we've done in the past isn't going to make us any more beloved. So I guess I would say that the administration has left many different options open in Latin America with Cuba, with Iran. Clearly, if you're right, that they're determined to find a way to engage the Iranian regime. On Arab-Israeli, they're clearly adopting a much more assertive role early. They put a lot of stock in what I would call transactional diplomacy. The notion that you have interests, we have interests, so let's sit down and see if we can make a deal.
Well, isn't that, I feel like you fall into the trap that I find a lot of the observers of this administration falling into. Isn't that a form of idealism? I mean, isn't the idea that you can cut a deal with everybody a tremendously idealistic approach to the world, and isn't the belief that, as you just stated, that if only we would sort of acknowledge our sins, that this would improve our position in dealing with other nations? Isn't that a form of incredible idealism?
Yeah, I think it's also a form of not idealism only. It's ideological.
Yeah, I mean, I reject this notion that first of all, I don't believe any administrations are non-ideological. I think even the wonderful George I think Jim Baker was pretty non-ideological, but I don't think George H.W. Bush was non-ideological. It's just that American idealisms take different forms, and what I see this administration, or at least this president, looking a lot like, is a true Wilsonian approach, what Wilson's always. When people say Wilsonian, they think it means democracy promotion. Wilson didn't invent democracy promotion as a policy for the United States. It long predated him. What he did invent was the idea of the United States leading the way toward solving the world's problems and bringing a permanent peace to the world.
Right.
That's a particular kind of idealism. And I would put Obama so far more in that category. And it'll be interesting to see. I mean, a true pragmatist might just say, hey, there's nothing to talk to the Iranians about. Let's just figure out a way to contain them and move on.
Right.
I'm not sure that that's less idealistic, this kind of approach. But I was asking another question, which I know you're fascinated in, which is the actual structure of the foreign policy-making apparatus.
Right.
Isn't that something you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, I it's curious because in that sense, it really is innovative. I mean, I worked for six secretaries of state and studied others, and the model that has proven to be not just most successful, it's the model that has existed, is the model of the engaged president who empowers the secretary of state, who then manages sub-cabinet-level officials and creates some priorities, owns a negotiation or a problem or two. And that's the way, depending on how the tick and tock of the world is concerned, what opportunities are available or created by deft diplomacy, that's the way that business gets done. This administration has departed from that model. It has, in several ways, it has created what I have referred to as an empire of envoys, in which very early in the administration, the Secretary of State willingly acquiesced in allowing some of the hottest button issues, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Arab Israeli, to be contracted out not just to sub-cabinet level officials, but to men, George Mitchell and Dick Holbrooke, who could have been the Secretary of State. So that's the first sort of anomalous aspect. The second is that the president himself seems to be emerging, not as the architect and controller of foreign policy. I mean, that's what presidents ultimately are responsible for, but the actual orchestrator. I mean, he has emerged. Cairo is one example, seems to me, and there are others, as the articulator-in-chief, the nation's chief diplomat-in-chief. And Dennis Ross's migration to the NSC seems to suggest that power, to the degree it's organized and concentrated in the administration, is flowing, you know, with a kind of magnetic force, like the moon pulling the tides to the White House. And I wonder how all of that is going to work out. I mean, the cases I know best, two of your favorite secretaries of state, Bob, you know, Henry Kissinger used Richard Nixon, both empowered and unempowered, particularly during the Watergate scandal, to operate in the president's name. But Kissinger, who managed, in this case, the Middle East diplomacy quite adeptly, and Jim Baker, who was extremely close to Bush 41, could operate because the president, you know, had his back and persuaded the rest of the world that Baker spoke for him. Now, in this new situation, I don't quite understand how it all works. What does the Secretary of State do in this new arrangement? What happens when it's time to set up a negotiation and then to close it? I mean, do the envoys report to the secretary, or do the envoys, say in the case of the Arab-Israeli issue, report directly to the president, and will he become involved early? I think presidential involvement is only a matter of time on the Arab-Israeli issue if things move along. So, again, I don't want to remain too much a prisoner of the past. As a historian these days, I suspect I am, but not sure how this new model is working.
I guess I never know how much weight to give the different ways that these apparatuses get set up. I mean, I could see what was... You saw what was right about the Baker State Department. I saw a lot of things that were wrong about the Baker State Department, the sort of disempowering of assistant secretaries, which I think led to mistakes in particular policy areas. But at the end of the day, I mean, one of the most dysfunctional foreign policy governments I've ever seen was the one I worked for, which was the Reagan administration. We had a national security advisor every 16 months, falling into some mess. We had a bureaucratic battle royal, as Schultz termed it, between Schultz and Weinberger. People thought that the president was quite disengaged. And yet, you know, somehow or other, we actually had, I think, quite a number of fairly large foreign policy successes, not necessarily in your particular area, but
right.
certainly in dealing with the Soviet Union, I would say in dealing with the Philippines and dealing with Asia in general. So I would say it was a pretty successful foreign policy with a pretty lousy apparatus. So I just never, I'm not saying you're wrong, I just never know how much weight to give this.
Well, I think you mentioned the key word, successful, and I think it really won't matter what the structure is if, in fact, we can deliver.
Right.
And delivering means creating a strategy, preempting potential crises, taking advantage of opportunities, managing crises. And, frankly, Iran is, again, a real anomaly because it's probably the most consequential event that has occurred on this administration's watch. And yet it's forced, for any number of reasons, some are quite legitimate, to wait and observe and to analyze rather than to act. So we haven't really had,
yeah.
whether it's the 3 a.m. phone call or the test or whatever, however you want to describe it, we really haven't had the crisis yet which would watch the structure in operation. I suspect you're probably right that it'll probably come out, let's hope, okay.
Yeah. But you're still, you're very troubled by it, nevertheless, Aaron.
Well, troubled. I'm, you know, what can I say? I mean, I worked for 6 secretaries of state. I liked them all. They all had their special skills. But one in particular emerged as a real force. And I think that right now, given the shape of the world, we need a foreign policy team that understands things, that are really smart, really tough, devious to an extent.
Well, I think most people would say you've just described our Secretary of State very well. I mean, that's the only part of this that I don't quite get. You know, there's a lot of news stories about, well, does the Secretary of State have a lot of power? And everybody assures us that, of course, she does. She's a very strong person. She's a very smart person. She knows a lot of these issues pretty well from, you know, having been involved in one way or another for a long time. You wouldn't have said, in fact, before the administration, when you heard who was being named, you never would have said, oh, wow, we're going to have a weak Secretary of State, right?
No. In fact, I had a piece in the LA Times a couple of weeks after her announcement, and I argued that to really be an effective Secretary of State, you needed several things. You needed a very strong intellectual and physical persona. She's got it.
Yep.
I mean, when she walks in the room, people are on the edge of their chairs.
That's right.
Number two, you needed someone who really was tough and devious, and I think she's suffered a lot. She's had her own share of crises. I think she's a very tough lady. You need a relationship with the president. The president really, really has to watch your back and support you. And arguably, she even though obviously it's a very curious situation, not team arrivals. I mean, I think they hijacked Doris Kearns Goodwin's concept and tried to apply it to this administration. The one thing I wondered whether she had is what I call the negotiator's mindset, which is to looking at the world like it was a chessboard. And having a very instrumental view of life, that's only tested, frankly, in a negotiation, and that's something that's not learned. It's either got it or you don't. Now, we haven't seen her operate in that environment yet, so you're absolutely right. It's curious that amidst all this talk of ebbing and flowing and power moving to the White House, I still ask the question, and maybe we'll only know when she engages on a discrete issue which she owns, and fixes how she conceives of her own role right now.
Yeah.
Very curious.
Well, I think it may turn out that the whole idea of having a quote-unquote team of rivals is more problematic and less wonderful than it seemed when Doris Kearns Goodwin set out the idea.
Right.
You know, I mean, the mere fact that you had rival campaigns with now set up in the administration battling over personnel issues, for instance, which has had, I think part of the reason we have all these rumors about the power flowing to the White House is they've won a lot of the personnel battles, right? And we'll see whether that ultimately matters. But that could just be misleading, and as you say, when we get into real crises and real negotiations, I think it's just too early to say where the real power is going to be.
I think that's probably right.
So we got about 10 minutes left. You're writing a book about great presidents.
I am, actually.
And
yeah.
I can't wait to read it. Who's on your list of the greatest presidents, and what's your theory about what makes great presidents great?
I mean, I'm toying now with a conceit that is still in its experimental stages. It argues initially that we've had three truly great presidents. They belong in a class and a category of their own. One in the 18th century, George Washington. One in the 19th, Abraham Lincoln. And one in the 20th, Franklin Roosevelt. And what links those three together are several elements. It doesn't mean that other presidents haven't done great things or don't belong in a class of outstanding or truly excellent chief executives, but these three stand out in large part because they each, and no coincidence, they presided over the three greatest challenges, crucibles really, to the creation of America as a nation. War of Independence and the birth of the Republic, Civil War, and the Great Depression and World War II. So calamity, or what I would call a nation-encumbering challenge, calamity or a nation-encumbering challenge is really very important in our system, which is slow to react. It's really important to lay the basis for greatness. Now, what you do with that calamity or crisis really then determines your greatness as a leader. Now, and I would argue that the second element is character, but not character in the sense that you have moral integrity. Character, as the Greeks meant it, literally, what you do with the physical and intellectual persona that you have. Can you project it? Can you seamlessly become part of your policy? That is to say, the president becomes the message and puts himself literally in the middle of the mix. I would argue Washington is really an exception here because there were no presidents before him. He created many precedents, but he truly was the indispensable man in so many respects, distant and aloof though he may appear to us. He had this sense of persona, and he put himself in the middle of the mix. Lincoln, for sure, and FDR, whose wheelchair became, in a way, his own log cabin, according to one historian, and created tremendous courage and, at the same time, sensitivity, even though he sought to hide it from the majority of the American public with the active cooperation of the media at the time. So character as persona is important. And then, actually, you've just given me an idea, the three C's, calamity, character, and the third one is competence. That is to say, how do you actually manage what you have? And in managing it, do you leave a legacy behind that is not just a relationship to the crisis that you fixed? Do you push the nation on some very important aspect of its political, constitutional, or even foreign policy soul? And do you leave the nation for generations afterwards stronger? Now, calamity, character, and competence, I think, define greatness in presidents. The question then becomes, what do you do with the other presidents? What do you do with presidents like Jackson? And I know what you think of Jefferson, Bob. So let's give him credit just for the Louisiana Purchase, which probably was the most consequential act of executive decision-making until Harry Truman decided to drop the bomb. Single act.
Unconstitutional, I want to make that clear as well.
Well, no. And Jefferson, wrestled with that, then understood, obviously, that look at the opportunity. But what do you do with presidents
strengthen,
like Jefferson?
Strengthen the slaveholding states and ultimately produce the Civil War.
Louisiana Purchase. Right, because no one was prepared. You're quite right to take on the question of expansion of slavery.
And the northern states opposed it because they knew it was going to strengthen the slave states, which Jefferson did not mind doing. But anyway, we'll discuss that at greater length sometime.
You know, what do you do with Jefferson, Jackson, T.R., who without a crisis was a kind of crisis unto himself and anticipated some important things like conservation. Strengthen the presidency, even Wilson and Truman, and perhaps one of the most controversial figures of all, and I have to account for him, in the section of the book called The Absence of Greatness, which is how come we haven't had another great president since FDR, what do you do with Reagan?
Well, I know what I do with Reagan.
I know what you know, and I think there's an argument there that in certain respects, Reagan becomes the most consequential president since FDR. So I'm looking to try to help Americans think through these issues in an election year. Now, the book, it's got three sections, the presence of greatness, the absence of greatness, and the promise of greatness. What would it take to produce a truly consequential and transformative president today? And is Barack Obama, as you suggested in the foreign policy realm, half seriously, or maybe not seriously at all, somebody who can be transformative and can really change America? I mean, we're not going to know that for a while yet. But it's a really interesting book, and I'm hoping to shed some light on this in a fresh and clear way.
Okay. Well, it sounds interesting, and don't use it all up here. You know, you got to sell the book when the book's actually coming out. So
I do.
You don't want to sell 3 years in advance. You know,
we need to talk more often, whether it's on Blogging Heads TV or not. I learn a lot from you, and I want to continue this.
That goes double for me, Aaron. Thank you very much.
It was terrific, Bob. Take care of yourself.
We'll talk again. Bye bye.
Bye bye.